Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine others, and I'm reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
And it is time once again for another crazy ass after rotten afternoon, evening, morning, whatever the hell time you actually listen to this sort of thing. I am here, we are here, and I have a guest tonight by the name of Walter Ryan. How's it going?
Good, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. I like to have people on here because that way I can pick their bones. Whether or not there's still meat on their bones afterwards, that's a whole nother question of stories.
There's plenty of meat on mine, unfortunately.
Okay, well, I do have to say one thing. You use the exact same picture on your media stuff.
Yeah. I guess I should update that. I didn't realize it's getting close to 10 years old now, but...
Exactly. It's like that.
Yeah. Well, I figure, you know, it's like Coca-Cola. It's just your brand. Just throw it out there. At least it is legitimately me.
Well, you've seen my picture, right? My profile picture right
perfect.
There?
Yeah.
That is me. A friend of mine was doing an art book or whatever, and he decided he wanted some pictures of people, and did thousands of layers. It's like, dude, that's intense, and I'm so glad you're the artist guy, and I'm not. So, tell us a little bit about who Walter is.
Oh, boy. Well, I write over there with Perseid Press, like you do. My most recent novel came out with Burning Bulb Publishing. Going back, I graduated with a degree in English literature from University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. After I graduated, I moved to Lima, Peru.
Lima?
I went to Lima, Peru. I was one of those guys who would go to college for a semester, then work for 8 months. So I graduated with no debt.
And I was like, good.
We used to get so fed up. I'd go to classes and I just couldn't take. I'd go to semester and I don't know. A lot of people rave about their college experience, but I was kind of frustrated the whole time. So I finished it. I got my degree in English literature, but I finally finished up with a minor in physics just because I was getting fed up with my English classes. Which people usually laugh about.
Yes, but going from English to physics is a bit of a... It's like, what? Because that's what I would have done. I was maths, English, and physics, and chemistry. And
people laugh, but I say physics, they used to call it natural philosophy. So now it makes sense.
Natural philosophy back in the old days was a little bit different than physics.
Yeah, well, it just kind of... But I mean, physics is still the most philosophical of the scientific disciplines you could get into. And it kind of... It's like, oh, okay. So the big difference was I'd sit in an English class and you'd tell the teachers, like, well, show that you know more than me. They'd just kind of sputter and they'd be kind of arrogant. They'd posh. You go to a physics teacher and say, show that you know more than me. And they just start writing. And within 2 seconds, like, yeah, that guy knows more than me.
Yeah. So
that's why it was easier. I could just go and believe in a physics class.
I can relate to that. I can relate to that a lot, actually. That's actually... Yeah. All right. So, I mean...
Well, it was strangely relaxing to be in those classes. It's like, I'm not paying all this $80 per credit to listen to these, undergraduates talk, frankly. I want to listen to the guy with the PhD talk.
Yeah, you want to listen to the smart guy talk, so he's going to say, okay, I want to learn something. Yeah, you know something. I want to learn what you're saying.
Yeah. And plus, I just was like... Towards the end of my degree, I'm like, I need to get something that I can actually use to get food with. You know, this literature degree is not going to cut it, probably.
Sorry, I'm just trying making a mention here. And I wonder if EW is paying attention in the background.
So I finished up my degree and I moved to Lima, Peru. And the idea with that was I was going to learn to speak Spanish because I was thinking of getting a master's degree. But once I got down there, I realized I could live there for almost nothing.
Yes.
And so I got a job teaching English and other jobs translating and being an editor, and I was writing articles at the time. So I stayed down there for 10 years.
Well, that sounds like a cost-effective way to do it.
Oh, Well, it's one of those things, once you get used to getting your insurance for $200 a year, you know, your health insurance, it's kind of hard to come back to the United States.
Well, add that in the fact that you've got all those wonderful extra charges for your individual health experiences for each and every single, oh, I hurt my foot. Yeah. That'll be $600. What?
Yeah. I'm just coming through that because I went into the hospital, and they rush you through it. All they see you as mobile. They see you as little mobile ATM. And they don't, I mean, it's not even an effort to fix you. I was sick 3 weeks ago. I went in. I had just this fever. I was trembling. Something was wrong with me. I go into the ER. And first of all, they ask you, they're like, well, what's your pain level? And I'm just like, I don't know, a 4? I'm not crying. Well, it turns out the answer you give when they ask what your pain level is you say 10. Because it's not, they're not asking what your pain level is really. They're asking you, how seriously should I take you? So just answer the question, how seriously should I take you? And then it's a 10. So I went in there and I had a pain in my leg. They checked me out. They're like, oh, you can go home. I'm like, okay. So I went home. Well, a day later, I go back into the hospital and it turns out I had cellulitis. It's a severe leg infection, just a weird thing. So the doctor's like, whoa, why didn't you come in before? I did come in before. But it's like the U.S., you know, the ER is like a $2,000 visit just for going into the ER. So I'm looking forward to paying, you know, that for no treatment.
That's just crazy shit.
Yeah, fortunately, they seem to have it fixed now.
Okay, well, that's good, because pain is not exactly the funnest thing in the world to do. Even being old, it's like I'm getting on the older side. It's like, I'm not looking forward to those parts of the time.
I'm getting there, too. I'm finding I'm squinting more. I might have to break down and get some glasses here.
I just finally got reading glasses 2 weeks ago.
Ugh. Is it working better? Is it working out for you?
Oh, hell yeah. It's actually, I can now reach it and not be getting the headaches.
It's like, damn it, I got old.
I just, damn it, I got old. I hate that.
Yeah, happens to the best of us.
All right, so you would probably call and classify yourself as a fantasy writer, yes?
Yeah, I write fantasy. The other thing I do, there's kind of this, it's like a memoir style. It's not really a memoir, but I like, my other books are Beyond Berkey Fever, which is a book about cross-country ski racing, and then I have a book about my experiences in Peru.
Would that be The Reckless Traveler?
Yeah, Reckless Traveler. And it's basically a collection of all the best stories I used to tell when I came back. You know, after you traveled for 10 years, you're like, well, this happened, and I told the same story so many times, I was able to put them all together and make a semi-coherent narrative out of it. That's also with Percy Press.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, most of the stuff I know you about is basically fantasy, because that's what Percy Press is, their big focus is all on fantasy stuff.
Yep.
How did you get connected with Percy?
Actually, I'd written a book with Ramalda Publishing. That book has been taken, that's The Bone Sword, that's with Heron Press now. I was just promoting it, so I put up a Facebook group called Heroic Fantasy, and Janet Morris was just one of the people that jumped onto that group, and I knew her from her books. I'd read her books back when I was younger, and just kind of got chatting with her, and from there, I just at some point submitted a manuscript to her. It's one of the, I've published now with 5 different small presses, and every single one of those contracts has come from a different way, and you know, it's just kind of, the more interaction you get with other writers, and the more you're just promoting other people's stuff, I mean, opportunities just kind of spring up from nowhere.
Absolutely. It's a wacky, wild, wonderful world.
Yeah.
So, from what I understand, you're mostly on the Heroica side of things with Perseid.
Yep, I did. Well, I've got that series, my dystopian series, The Reader of Acheron and The Literate Thief are the 2 books in that, and I'm finishing up the 3rd one. I'm about halfway through what'll be the 3rd book in that series. That series could go on forever, but I'm tying up a lot of things in it, yeah.
Well, whatever you do, don't pull a Robert Jordan.
Oh.
I mean, I loved his writing. Absolutely loved his writing. But after the 4th or 5th book, it was like, is there an ending in this book?
Yeah.
There's no ending in this book. It's going into the next book already, and I got to wait another year now for that? Yeah. I'm not so much a fan of that.
I got frustrated when I was reading Game of Thrones before it became a TV show, and I gave up on it, too. It's just like, it started to feel like I was just getting played with. And
Game of Thrones was fun to read. I mean, at least they ended each book.
I liked it up until, I think I read the first three books, and then, I mean, I was only reading it for Tyrion at that point, and then he just didn't show up in the fourth book. But I was just feeling... It made more sense when it became a TV show. It's like, oh, now I understand, because it's like it makes, you know, it just keeps going, and you're like, okay, this is something fun to watch. In a book, I like my qualifications for a book. I like it to have a reason beyond just, you know, there's the moment you're engaged for the moment, and Game of Thrones has that in spades. But I also like there to be a larger thread that becomes clear after you're a certain amount of time into the book.
Big story, little story. Big story, little story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's got that arcing theme. There's a reason you're there. There's something you're going to carry away from the book. I just wasn't finding it in the book version of Game of Thrones. I really enjoy the show, of course. Everybody does, but...
Who doesn't? Well, apparently there are some. There are a couple of people, some people who don't.
Those same people don't like bacon. You can't please
What the hell's wrong with that, eh? It's like, how can you not like bacon? Bacon is like... Yeah. Bacon is like... The cornerstone crux of the universe.
Well, there's an evolutionary reason for that, I guess. I guess maybe the tainted bacon and the human race will survive because of those folks. That's what happens. Everything's got a reason.
Well, you know, everything can be bacon, right? There is chicken bacon out there.
I was just thinking tainted bacon. That's a good title for something. That should either be a short story or a song or maybe a band.
Okay, tainted well, if you're going to go on down this road, I was part of an anthology called Baconology.
Oh, there you go.
Every story was about bacon.
Oh, good.
Yes. It was an unusual glorious collection of stories. But, yes, all good, clean fun. So, with fantasy, I'm mostly a horror writer, but I do some fantasy and I do some science fiction as well myself. What do you think is like a big... big difference between the different genres that we call on this side of the equation with like fantasy, horror, and sci-fi?
Actually, that's funny. I was just reading... Okay, so let me have a roundabout way of answering that. This year, I'm just making more of an effort this year to read as many local writers or people that I find. I think it's... We don't do enough of reading each other's stuff and promoting it, so I've been trying to do more of that myself. So one of the books I just read was a romance novel, which I've never read before. It's like, well, you read this? And I was like, well, why not?
Sure.
So, and it was just striking as I was reading it. So this was called, the book is called Russian Gold. Holly Bargo, that's the name of the author. As I was reading it, it just struck me, okay, there is 3% of the book is sort of like descriptive sex scenes, but not more descriptive even than, you know, I mean, Game of Thrones has descriptive sex scenes.
Yep.
And it just occurred to me, it's like, well, this is just a character-driven story. These are people. And it's just like the difference between any genre is just a couple, you know, a couple paragraphs here and there. Some things you choose to describe. I mean, a good story, you can pick up. I always hate it when people are like, well, I hate fantasy or I hate science fiction. My go-to with that was, it's like, well, did you like Vanilla Sky? That's science fiction. But it's like anything that's done well, you know, you're going to enjoy. I like fantasy just because you get to cut people's heads off.
Yeah.
You know, you can have regular people do that.
There's
so many people who need to have their heads cut off.
Hey, Ned Stark did not need to have his head cut off.
That's true.
But they did it anyways.
I'd read the books, you know, and then so I was watching Game of Thrones with my wife, and I was just, you know how there's all those YouTube people videotape their buddies because they know these scenes are going to happen?
Yeah, the reaction scenes.
So they get
scenes?
The reaction videos.
Yep. Yep.
So I didn't think to tape my poor wife when that happened, but it was pretty glorious. What? We have to watch the next chapter because you think he's coming back, and then in the next chapter they got like his head on a stake covered in tar or something. It's like, nope.
He ain't coming back from that one. Nope. And then the Red Wedding.
Yeah, yeah. That's another good one.
Oh, my God. There's such great scenes in this. It's like, you can't believe that anybody's going to survive. Well, yes. You can believe that some people are going
to
survive.
Somebody's line about the Red Wedding was when they started stabbing her in the stomach. They're like, why'd they have to stab her in the stomach like it was a microwave dinner?
Well.
The best literature of our age is in the comments of articles, I think. There's some funny stuff people write.
There is, and sometimes there's some really sad stuff that they write, but We try to ignore those.
Well, at least they got passion. Okay. As long as they have passion.
So you bring up the good thing about the you bring up a good point about the romance novels, is because I know a lot of horror people that also write romance novels.
Yeah.
I was like,
no, you can't be closed-minded about. Every time I've read a book that's outside of my genres, I've always found something in it to enjoy. So it's I don't know. If I'll try writing one of those one day, maybe. I don't know.
I have absolutely zero intention of even ever trying to write one of those. But I do agree with your point about the whole
check, and I'll make an effort.
Yeah, it's you're right about the point. It's like the whole story, the whole idea behind a romance novel is to engage the reader so that they enjoy the ride.
Yeah,
and that's
the
same thing with any good story.
Yeah, as long as they have characters that you are interested in, and well, this one had a guy who was he was involved with the Russian mafia, and he was a cage fighter, so it was like, okay, that guy's kind of interesting. So.
Yes, and all of that. Yeah. So, obviously you watch some of the fantasy stuff and the movies and stuff and the TVs and the stuff, and it's like, do you have an indication or an idea that's like, hey, my thing would be great as a...
Oh, the Reader of Acheron, the Slaves, that's the series that's called The Slaves of Erephor, I think it'd make, it would make, I'd love to see it adapted. I mean... If anybody was to adapt it to any kind of screen, that would be fantastic. Heck, I'd like to see a professional version of it, you know, a professional audio version of it. At some point, Perseid might do that. They do audio versions of their books. So.
Yeah, they have. I mean, Chris has done an amazing job with Janet's books.
Yeah. Well, The Reader of Acheron is a dystopian, so you could do it fairly inexpensively. All you got to do is go find some, abandoned, factories and things, and you can film it.
That is true.
The first book is limited amount of characters, so it works pretty well. It's more elaborate by the time you get to the second ones, but if you make the first one and that's successful, then you got money to spend on the second one, would be the idea.
That sometimes works and then sometimes fails.
Yeah.
I will give you a case in point. Thanksgiving.
They had money, and then what happened? I know that's the one where the turkey's killing everybody.
Yes, they had no money on the first one. $4,000 budget.
Yeah.
Then they got a lot of money, and then they made a sequel about the trying to find the second sequel that never happened. So it was Thanksgiving, and then Thanksgiving 3. And Thanksgiving 3 was in the search for Thanksgiving 2.
Yeah, that's like the numerology of Rambo, too, because it's First Blood, Rambo, and then Rambo 3.
Yeah. That's just some crazy shit, the way they go with that.
Actually, another one was Blair Witch Project. So they had no money for the first one and money for the second one, and it also tanked.
But I like the second one way better than the first one.
I didn't see the second one. I just remember the first one made me seasick. Plus, I mean, we're from Wisconsin, so we were watching this movie like they walked into the woods and they got lost. Are they idiots? But I think it's like a movie that scares people that are from cities because they're just terrified of the woods. Us, guys like us in Wisconsin, we're just like, well, that's just a Tuesday afternoon.
Yes. Yes. And some of us city boys actually realize, like, yeah, that could be scary if you've never been in the woods before.
And it's like, you got a river. Follow the river. You'll be okay.
Exactly. River's going to go somewhere. Okay, good. That was over on that side that they were hearing that. Okay, wonderful. We won't look at that right now because there's some problems in the chat room.
People
are fighting.
Shoot.
People are fighting. They're pulling out the fisticuffs. No, they're not.
Them already? It's pretty early. It's only 19 minutes in.
We kind of like move quickly here. Oh yeah. By the way, fast zombies or slow zombies?
I think I prefer the fast ones. That's probably going to be unpopular, but I prefer the fast ones.
I like both myself, so I'm not going to really say anything. All I have to say is that a fast zombies is like such an unrealistic thing. It's like, wait, if they can run faster than you, y'all are dead.
Yeah.
That's it.
What was the first one they appeared in, though? I just remember when the first movie came out with fast zombies, and I was like, whoa.
Well, 28 Days Later was the one that pretty much made fast zombies a thing.
Well, they were just Tom Cruising it, these zombies in there. It was like intense zombie running.
Oh, yeah. But they had a different reason for what was causing it, so it was like, okay, that made sense.
They should have every zombie be Tom Cruise.
No, please, no. Please, please. He already is a zombie.
Yeah.
I mean, his acting is very zombie, so we won't go there. Although, mind you, the last two movies I've seen him in, I actually enjoyed him in.
Well, the more he runs, the more money his movies make. Are you aware of that? Little, that's another one of the things that I found that's great on the internet. The correlation between how much Tom Cruise runs and how successful his movies are.
Uh-huh.
Because he's the greatest of all time movie on-screen runner.
Okay.
With his eyes bugging out and his, something's wrong.
I'm not going to buy into it.
No, look it up. And it correlates. It's like the more he runs, like the distance he runs per film, the more money it makes.
Okay, I'll buy into your.
People in the chat room got to confirm this. This is universally known.
Actually, the problem right now is it's some audio glitching problems in there, so I don't think they can hear us too well right now.
Oh wow!
But EW's on the case fixing that shit. So,
well.
Do you actually get involved in any kind of horror stuff? Do you enjoy any horror?
I'm not too involved with it. It's not that it's something I avoid. There's a level of horror. I mean, I'm a fan of, like, The Shining. I kind of always hold off when it gets a little too... I'm kind of a dabbler in horror, I guess.
Okay, so you like some kinds of horror, but not the others.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Shining was a great movie. I liked it. The Christine in the same vein, on a different vein, but still a great... Christine's one of my favorite King adaptation movies.
That one I don't know. I guess
what?
The horror movies...
You don't know Christine? Don't...
What one is that? What's the
That's
spot?
The one about the car that's possessed and goes around killing people.
No, I don't know that one. No. Yeah, it's, okay, I'll rent it.
It's a good one to watch.
Now, there's these... The people that like... Because, I mean, a horror movie... A film is such an intense... media that you know, they can hit you with sound and they can hit you with flashing lights, and it still has to be story. When it starts being like just loud noises to make me jump, that's when I stop.
And that's the problem I had with Blair Witch. That's the problem I had with the first Blair Witch.
Yeah,
it was,
I hear you.
Huh?
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. Just like, well, that one, it made you sick just because of the shaky camera.
I got bored of Blair Witch like within the first 20 minutes. It's like, eh. This movie's not going anywhere quickly. It's like, oh, and then it goes to the point where they're in a room and it's like, oh, she's scared. Whatever. Yeah.
Well, that one was just a novelty because it was so, you didn't know what was going to happen, you know, because it was just not a Hollywood film. So it's like, well, and people were, I mean, even if you're not buying into it being like a true found footage thing, it's like, these aren't like people with a narrative who work at a big corporation pushing like the 12 things that are allowed to be in a film. You know what I mean?
I could put out tons of movies that says, well, see all those things you're supposed to put in? These movies didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And these movies are awesome.
There's that thing that's like the 12 points, like the 12 plot points that a film has to go, like boy loses girl right before the end and then they get back together. And it's like every single movie follows this, and it doesn't matter what genre it is. They all do the exact same things. So it's only in those small books. I mean, that's the same thing that's true with independent literature is independent film. You only get these kind of narratives that are different from the mainstream ones, but from these the independent or the small publishers or filmmakers.
True, and most formulaic type approaches is usually the big budget Hollywood stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well, the bigger budget it is, the less likely it is to, you know, divide from that.
To be interesting and unique and different and edgy and cutting and taking all that risks and stuff.
Yeah. Well, there was an insane directive from like in the 50s where they actually, I mean, the government actually got involved and said,
yes,
this is the kind of stuff that can be in movies. And they just made a list and everything had to be within that parameter.
Wasn't just the movies as well. It was also in literature. In comic books, they introduced the comic book code that said,
I didn't know about that.
No sex, no violence, no bloodshed, no none of this, no none of that, no none of this, no none of this. You can have anything else but those things.
Yeah.
And that was like...
And that's the main reason why... I mean, I really enjoy working with Perseid. I mean, Janet, she's always interested in ideas and things that are engaging. And
mm-hmm.
I've been published with 5 different little small presses, and I've never even tried to submit anything to a major press. Just because it's just not worth the... I mean, it's like, my impression is, it's like, well, there's so much arrogance, you know, in these bigger groups. And I just don't want to have to write that kind of stuff. I want to be free to write something that's what I think is interesting and engaging and important.
Fair enough, because that was going to be one of the series of questions we were going to talk about, was publishing and levels of publishing. Small press versus traditional pub. Have you even tried self-publishing?
Oh, yep. I did that back in the day when I started. It's just one of the, you know, it's like just like Mark Twain did with Huckleberry Finn.
Well, that's a whole different kind of self-publishing back then.
You know, though, it's one of those things where it's like, it's just so funny. Well, here's the thing I think is interesting. Like those scholar, or I guess it'd be a scholarly journal or an academic journal.
Yes.
If you get something published in an academic journal, you've paid to have that story published or that article published in an academic journal.
True.
So it's one of those things where I was like, well, that's self-publishing. Oh, no, it's not, they say, all offended. And it's like, there's nothing inherently offensive about saying something is self-published. It's just because you academics have created it. And it's really, it's like, why does it matter? If something is good, you should be engaging it. It doesn't matter where it comes from. I mean, just like this, you know, you start thinking like this massive for-profit publishing is the only place where we can have anything good. And you, and that's with just a complete dismissal of the smaller publisher. So or of self-published authors. So it's again, that's one of the things I make an effort to do is engage all these things. Go ahead.
Sorry. In that same vein, one of the major differences between a self-publisher, small press, and a traditional publisher is the traditional publisher. Yeah, they're making millions, billions of dollars, whatever, but they're only focusing on 5% of their actual authorship. They're saying, these 5% people, they make us money, so we do everything, we bend over backwards, do everything for them. We put them on book tours, we put them on promotional junkets, we get them coverage space time in the Washington Journal or whatever. And then the other 95% fend for themselves.
Yeah. It's almost like buying a patent, just so you don't have to develop the technology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then with self-publishing, you are it. So it's you can do as much as you can do. You make as much from what you do, or you make as little from what you do.
Yeah.
And then with small press, it's a partnership. You work together.
One of those things I think is interesting. It's just the attitudes and just how people perceive writing and how they think about it and what they think it all means. And most of it is this narrative that's been created probably in large part by the large publishers. One of the things I thought was funny. So there's that Wisconsin singer, that Chris Cruzy.
I do not know this person.
Well, he just came in second on The Voice. He's a singer. He's a big sensation now. Because he went from Wisconsin, so he's been performing in Wisconsin for all these years.
Does he sound like Justin Bieber?
No.
Okay, good, because I didn't like him either.
The point is, he goes out and he performs on The Voice, and he gets his, he's accepted now by the established singers, and now he's selling out venues here in Wisconsin. And it just strikes me as bizarre, because it's like, he was that good before he went out to go be on The Voice, right? So how come it doesn't work that you can develop your little grassroots roots following and then make the jump to the bigger, you know, the big leagues? Why is it that the big leagues have to anoint you and then the smaller places will start following you? So this has been kind of the catalyst for my change of philosophy this year, where I'm just making an effort to reach out, find a lot more local writers, pick up and just buy their books and read them and review them. I mean, it's just pretty basic. And I've only been doing this, you know, since the beginning of the year, and I've already met a lot of just really interesting, dynamic people. Jean Lee, I should send you the link, but she's another fantasy author. I just met her. Michael Dellert from the Heroes in Hell group. He sent me her name just because she was in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. She's written this fantasy book. It's called Fallen Princeborn. It is a fantastic book. I put up a review of hers, and it's like her social network is just fantastic. They've been retweeting and sending off this review of her book that I did. So it's just one of those things where I just don't understand. There's a lot of authors who just kind of sit passively, and I think they've just kind of been brainwashed by this perception of what the big league writers do. Like, it all comes to you, and it's like, the reality is, for anybody to pay attention to, you have to go out and start knocking on doors and, you know, make connections and do a couple things for other people, too.
And the funny thing about that is that's just not as just writers. That's everything. Everyone, mm-hmm. everywhere. You got a business, you only get successful if you are engaging and pushing that forward. I have also a comic shop as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a guest in this weekend, and the one thing we were talking about was nobody really gets it until you start doing it. And most people who are creative types, they don't like to do the other side of the business, which is the actual business, which is the getting out there, doing the things, doing the social promoting, doing all the little bits and pieces, actually writing down things and handing things out to people and doing stuff. They just want to make the stuff.
Yeah.
And I think society has built people to believe that that's where the dream is. But you sound like you enjoy doing the promotional side of things. And one of my biggest things I always tell about anybody in any of the creative industries is make friends.
Yep. No, absolutely. You need people to support. Well, you need people to come to your library things. And it's important to have a certain amount of power where if another author comes in, then you can bring a group to go watch that and just get people talking about it. I mean, yeah, it's all just this big social network that you have to create with people and have people be aware.
The big fancy word, synergy.
Yeah.
Sympathetic, synergistic. Oh, there was another one to it. Ah, stupid. But yeah, it's totally the same thing. I believe and agree with you 100%. Do you know Jonathan Mayberry?
I know the name. What is
He's got a series of books called V-Wars, Joe Ledger. The V-Wars is being picked up on a TV series right now. But he's published by some of the bigger publishing companies. Uh-huh. One of the things that I've always admired about him is that he actually enjoys engaging with people.
Yeah.
At conventions, online, or whatever, if you reach out to him, he'll answer.
Hmm.
And that's a cool thing because, I mean, once you get to a particular level in the game, most people think, oh, you're untouchable, or, oh, you got to be Mr. Fanboy to be able to connect with that person.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody always talks about how, I mean, there's something in the atmosphere of the literary community that says, well, we need to hear these voices more. You know, it's all old white guys, you know, we need to listen to more women or minority groups. But it's like, then they don't actually go through with it. I mean, there's only the only groups that they listen to are, you know, I mean, if you're from I'm a rural Wisconsin writer, that's not something that, you know, and it's not like, and my beliefs are not even the same as most rural Wisconsin writers, but you're going to be dismissed for whatever reason. There's a lot of voices that are silenced all the time. And it's funny that these same people that'll sit there and say, we have to listen to these other voices. Then just because they're kind of like, they've been hypnotized into thinking literature has to be a certain way, they participate in silencing other voices without even thinking about it.
Yeah. And I'll agree with the whole idea that literary often means to a number of people elitist.
Yeah.
I was like, literary just means well written.
It is kind of funny. That's one of the and to this day, I don't introduce myself as a writer just because it does. It sounds too elite, and it's like, and I'm not in that group that would call themselves a writer. And it's funny how so many people that are in that group never read anything or write anything. So,
well, I have to applaud you for actually picking up a romance book. I probably would never do that. I would read other stuff, but that romance book would be like, yeah, I'm sorry, that's going to bore the shit out of me.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised, though. It's just like, oh, I'll give it a try. And it was like, okay, this is just, it's like any other, book. It's got, except for these two dozen paragraphs. And
okay, I have to requalify that. Well-written book.
Yeah.
Because I tried reading Twilight.
Okay.
I read one page. It's like, yeah, no, you can burn this. I don't want to read it.
Well, at least I sat through the movies. My wife liked those, so I watched them. And it's like, well, at least it's got some vampire and wolf fights.
I'm sorry. I could not even bring myself close to watching that. It's like, I'm lucky and quite happy with the way that what I watch video-wise and entertainment-wise. I watch stuff from all over the world. I don't care. If it's good, I'll enjoy the crap out of it. If it's crap, I'm going to like, yeah, no, that sucks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love horror films from all over the world, from Korea, from Britain, from South Africa. There are some really good, talented people putting stuff out there, and they get sort of, like, sidelined all the time with all the Hollywood crap.
Horror is great just because you can make an effective horror film very inexpensively, so it's a great medium for people who are creative and they just don't have any finances and they can make an entertaining movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's as of any general perspective for a genre type movie of any type, it has the highest rate of return. Like on average.
I just read an article about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and it was going through it. It was just this, it was a love letter to the Texas, but it was convincing. It was going through particularly the last couple, the last sequence, and it was really an interesting article to read because that I haven't sat through that whole film, but after reading the article, I jumped on and watched the last 10 minutes, and it's like, yeah, it was good quality filmmaking for just, you know, I mean, you could tell it was inexpensively made and it was kind of cheesy, but it was also very, very effective. So
have you ever watched a trauma film?
Trauma? Nope. Don't know what that is.
Toxic Avenger?
Oh, okay. I saw the Toxic Avenger. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So Trauma is the company that puts out movies like that. They are known for putting out like really, really low grade movies that are just fun.
Yeah.
But crazy. But yeah. Let's get back to fantasy. No, actually, you know what? Let's go into marketing.
So, okay.
What are some of the best methods? I sometimes mix my words and they sometimes sound weird, and then I just keep going on anyways.
Yeah.
What do you think are some of the best methods to get your name and word and yourself out, other than what we've already talked about, making friends?
Yeah, it's always tricky. There's a lot of, actually lately what I've been doing, I've just been finding, I've been on Twitter a lot lately. I never did that before much, except for to just sync it up with my blog so it puts stuff there. But it's kind of fun where you can jump on Twitter and tweet directly to people like the president.
Have you tried that?
Yeah, I've been doing that. Well, Donald Trump Jr. is a fun guy to tweet to because he just always says something. And the trick is because he'll tweet something, and if you happen to see it when it's only got a couple comments, if you put a comment in there, all of a sudden you're getting 10,000 views of your thing, so it comes back to your profile. Although I don't know if he might sick the Secret Service on me if I keep hassling him.
Well, but they might.
Go ahead. But I've been meeting a lot of just writers and blogs and things, and so lately I've just been doing, you know, seeing if they want to either do an interview or I've been offering to review books.
You mean like this one?
Mine. Yeah, like this kind of thing. I got this last book that's come out. It's with Burning Bowl Publishing. This is an interesting little project because I did it with a co-author. I've never done that before. And we finished the book, and we were looking for a place to publish it, found a little publisher that had a nice... Their Facebook page has 40,000 subscribers. I'm like, okay, maybe they can give us a little, you know, heads up. And just my co-author, Dan Wall, he had a buddy who used to be I can't remember the name, this guy's title. He was a big deal. He gave us a nice blurb. And then with this blurb, we were able to, you know, you're sending it around to different publications. But I've written for a lot of the local publications. So the local one in Eau Claire is Volume 1. It's sort of like the local artist magazine. Mm-hmm. So I've written articles for them before. And they did they were willing to do a review of this new book. So they put that on their page. Then the local librarian, he picked it up. This is a good one, though, because a lot of going to libraries is really important. And whether you're approaching libraries or they're approaching you, most of these libraries will give you a little bit of a honorarium for showing up. So, you know, and it's important to polish your speaking skills. So we set up a presentation. I always bring in slides and I start out with background information, pictures from when, you know, I went and met Janet Morris out at the Library of Congress. So I have a nice picture of that. So it both makes the librarian feel you're semi-legitimate. It's like, well, I spoke at the Library of Congress, too. So
there you go.
Here now. You know, things like that. So you have the pictures. I always have my Machu Picchu and Chocaquitao pictures and just talk about other things that I've done. So you do the library tours. Always make sure at the library tour you have a blog post that goes along with it so you can give a little bit more attention to your other other articles that have been getting media attention. Get the emails of everybody who's at the place. I mean, the local writers I want to just meet and talk to. But these things kind of have a snowballing effect. So when we were doing our Chippewa Falls library presentation, the Eau Claire College newspaper contacted us and interviewed us. So just be engaging. We have another interview with a lot of the local papers. But this wasn't easy. I mean, this latest book, I'm getting a lot more media attention than I have in the books from the books prior to that. And I think it's just having been around a while after, you know, once you have a whole list of places that have written something about you, you can send off on the new release, they're a little bit more likely to pay attention to you.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things you were speaking about earlier triggered a memory of a thing, and it's like, I wanted to interject then, but got sidetracked. he was an overnight success. Spent 10 years getting there.
Yeah.
That's totally the case.
Well, one of the things I did, and this was at Dan's urging, I wrote this article, my Speaking Spanish in America article, because my wife is from Peru, so I always speak to my kids in Spanish. So I kind of do it loudly in public because I know it makes some people angry. even though it's like in the United States, there's no official language. You know, you're allowed to speak whatever language you want, but I know people get offended when I'm speaking in Spanish. But, you know, I'm 6 feet tall and 200 pounds and nobody says anything, but sometimes my wife and my kids will sometimes be hassled, you know.
Really?
So it's like all these tough guys who won't tell me not to speak Spanish, they'll tell them not to. So I wrote this article called Speaking Spanish in America, and I just sent this in as a letter to the editor for the Eau Claire paper. Well, it ended up being shared 100,000 times.
Nice.
It had like 2,000 comments on it. And most of the comments were very positive. But this is the thing that was weird about that. And we were talking about before how, like, the literary community is kind of rigged. Because so if an article gets shared 100,000 times, this at the time was the most read online article for the Eau Claire paper. If it gets shared that many times, just the ads on it should be worth about $1,000.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, well, okay, you know, the newspapers are struggling, this and that. So I wrote them right after. I was like, well, I was going to do a follow-up called You Have the Right to Speak Spanish in the United States, because I learned all this stuff about how the United States has no official language and how there's more Spanish speakers in the United States than in Spain. So I was going to write this article, and they told me, they're like, well, we can't publish another thing from you for 30 days. And I was just like, well, this makes no sense. And, you know, it's like, if you're a for-profit, you know, institution, you should want to strike while the iron's hot. I mean, this one, it's like, just put a link to the follow-up article at the bottom of this article, and then you'll make another $1,000, maybe. Nope, we don't want to publish another article from you. So then I published it in volume one. But the other thing that was funny about that was the comments. So there was a Facebook plugin. I was just spending the whole night. I'm sitting there replying to all the comments. People were writing their stories about times they'd been hassled.
No!
Yeah, Facebook shut me down.
So rule number one! Don't reply to all the comments.
Okay. But it's like, why wouldn't you? It's like, it's a completely legitimate. So I'm sitting there writing to people. They're writing these. They're asking me questions. And it's like, but it's like, you know, it's like, yeah, I mean, you're reacting in terms that you knew that Facebook would shut you down. But it's like, why should they? I mean, it seems to me like they were asking for me to reply to them.
Okay. So on the one side, yeah, total cool. It's like, you got people who are engaging. They want to get interested. It's a discussion. But on the side of Facebook, Facebook is getting so much shit from everyone all around, from the corporate and government side of things. They've put into them all of these algorithms that basically say, if you post like a robot, you must be a robot.
Yeah.
I've had it happen to me. I've had my account shut down for a couple of days because, like, they thought I was a robot because I type fast. I type bloody fast.
The sad part of that is there's no part of that algorithm that's... But I get conned into stuff like that all the time. And I'm one of these people that I never, like, the first time I bought an Apple product, like, I bought an iPod, and the first thing I wanted to do was download my hard drive onto it. And it's like, oh, I can't do that.
So yes, you can.
This was like the first, I couldn't win at the time when I got it. So
actually, at first, when they first came out, that was when it was the easiest to do it. Now it's even harder.
Yeah. But it's sort of like, instantly I get a tool and I use it for other than its intended purpose, and it's just the way my brain's wired, you know.
Meh.
I mean, things like, I used to come back from Peru and I would think to myself, well, if I don't have any baggage, you know, they're not gonna think I'm smuggling anything in. So I'd be in Peru for 3 months and I'd come back to the United States with nothing, and then I'd raise red flags, like, why don't you have any clothes, or why did you bring anything back?
Totally.
Like, well, I thought this would seem like I'm more innocent. It's like, no, now you're suspicious.
Exactly.
It's like everything in my life, I'm always drawing attention, or I'm always doing something contrary to what people want. Yeah, I mean, and it sounds like you're in the same thing. We're getting banned from these things, and it's like, well, why is this here? You know, it's sort of like there's all these Facebook groups, and it's like writers supporting other writers. It's like, well, here's a link to a local paper that did a review of me. Well, you're not supposed to post things like that. It's like, what the hell? What's the point of this group then?
Yes. This is the funny thing about Facebook is, like, you can go into any kind of group. It's like, I don't want you adding me. I'm going to remove you from my Facebook list if you add me to stuff. It's like, dude.
Yeah.
I post this rule very clearly, very simply, every time. You add me to, or you ask me to like your page, I am going to ask you to like two of mine.
Yeah, oh, that's fair.
And as long as you do that, I'm cool with it. It's all about the turnabout and making everybody happy and working a system. That's cool. But if you instantly friend me and then ask me to like something, I'm going to look at you and say, do I care? No! Bye-bye. I care? Yes, I do. That sounds interesting. Great. Okay, let's interact.
Well, yeah, and then it's like Reddit, I was posting on various Suggest Me a Book pages. It's like, yeah, here's this review of this book I did. And then I'm actually getting comments on the posts like, oh, this is great. This is exactly what I'm looking for. But then one person is like, well, this is spam. And then instantly you're out, you know? It doesn't matter if you've had 10 positive comments. One guy says it's spam. Oh, we blocked you from this group forever.
Okay.
Don't try and sign up with a different account.
Okay. No. Oh, okay. I gotta throw this one out. I won't say names or anything about people. I have a thing that I do on Facebook where I put birthday greetings. I write up a little poem every day, and then I put up a birthday greeting. I tag somebody in one, and they sent me a nasty message that said, this is spam. I don't want to be part of your promotional things. Like, dude, it was a birthday greeting.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, don't read it. Block me. I don't care. Just don't give me any anger about it. It's like, that's just making you sound so dumb.
I had one like that where somebody sent me one of these things. It's like 100 things to be happy about. And so I was just reading through it. I remember I just rewrote it as 100 things to be mad about or unhappy about. It was just like, it was comic because I took every one of the ones that they listed and I just kind of twisted it to make it something horrible. So I sent it back to the person who sent it. They sent me back, F you. That's all I got. Like, boy, I was like, I thought it was funny. Oh, well.
It probably was. But some people just get bent out of shape on stuff. And it's like, okay, if you don't like it, just chill and just walk away from it.
Well,
like this,
I think it's they're just so committed to following rules, and they find people that are like, I was telling my kids this the other day. So my kids are 8 and 6, and I just told them, I'm like, there's rules you have to live by, and there's some rules that are just stupid.
Yes.
And what brought this up was they were at a sledding party. It was like a first grade sledding party, and the teacher had given out, you know, it was at the school, a school sponsored sledding party. So she'd given out this list of like sledding safety tips. And I'm just like, which of these stupid sledding safety tips can we ignore, you know? And I'm just like, and we were trying to see how many of the sledding safety tips we could break on each run down the hill.
Okay, then.
Like, look, Daddy, I'm breaking the rules.
Oh, that's right. Good. You're in Wisconsin, so you get snow.
Yeah. You don't get any in Canada?
Oh, hell yeah, we get some. We got a snowstorm today. We got about almost a foot of snow dumped in the one day.
Yeah, we've had a couple good days of that. We didn't have any throughout January, and all February we've been just getting hammered.
Yeah. Did you get the ice storm as well?
Not really ice storm. It's been big powdery fluffy snow that's easy to shovel. We were out digging snow caves today.
That was today's snow, is the powdery. It's like, okay, this is just like dandruff, God's dandruff throwing on the ground there or whatever. The other two were like, oh, okay, that's nice snow turned into solid ice. The one before that, oh, that's great snow, look how wet that is, that's heavy.
We've had a lot of snow days this year, which is always fun, where the kids stay home. And my wife works in the school district, too, so the whole family gets a snow day when it's a snow day. So.
Oh, well, lucky you.
Yeah.
I don't get snow days.
Ah, that's too bad.
It's like, I got to go to work. Why do I got to go work? I got to make money so I can keep doing other stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's always pain.
So let's like now talk about the actual writing process a bit.
Okay.
So do you do a lot of world building?
I don't think it's not, I wouldn't say it's, no, not with the latest books that I do, not with the dystopian book. It's, well, that's a, I mean, that's like a shattered earth type thing. So it's, and there's a structure to the society that they work through that's really important to the book, but I don't, yeah.
It sounds like I know the next answer here. So the next question would be pants or plot? So it sounds like you're much more of a panter.
A panter? Taking pants?
No, you run by the seat of your pants.
No, well, it's more character. So I invent my characters, and then I kind of, because I have characters who have very strong beliefs in certain things, and then you put them together in a room is kind of my way of doing it. Where it's like, you know, this guy's going to hate this other guy. What happens when they have to have a conversation? Or what happens when one of them is in the room with the other one and one of them's tied up?
So you start with the people, not with the world.
It's more that. Well, the Reader of Atron is a world where it's almost, I almost like to refer to it as it's a very serious book, but I almost like to call it satire, because it's a world where reading is outlawed. But in practical use, even in that society, the richest or the powerful part of that society, the elites, they blatantly read. So it's like they have a set of rules that they only use so that they can exploit poor people with.
Well, that's like much of early society.
Well, much of modern. I always say it's like people are like, "Whoa, wouldn't the world be?" People would write reviews and say, "Wouldn't the world be terrible if it was like this book?" And I'm like, "I think this is the way the world is."
Well, a number of places in the world, yes, I would agree with you.
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of it came as a reaction to just how, you know, we have intellectuals. I mean, are dismissed. Any kind of scientific inquiry is dismissed. There's just kind of the war on the scientific method. So you have people that, you know, want to better themselves, but they're within a society that celebrates just ignorance, which is our society. So true. That's kind of the part of the book. But I mean, I think that's kind of far out there. I don't, you know, when people read the book, they'll read it as an adventure novel.
Okay, well, that's good. And one of the other questions I was going to ask around here is, like, looking at modern day politics and social things happening around the world, do you take any of that and build that into the stories you try and build?
It's a fundamental plot, how people exploit each other, how evil people work is universal. So if you're being very specific about what modern politicians are doing, I think you're kind of missing the point. You want to write kind of a handbook for establishing a good society that's applicable to anything and not, you know, specific examples that happen to be coming up today. You get rid of Trump and you're still going to have problems, you know.
True. I mean, we can look at right now, I am currently reading in the news about 5 different hotspots of potential violence that could spill over into major shit.
Yeah.
And it's not just one person doing it. It's like, well, you got that one kind of guy over there, and then you've got this kind of guy over there, and you've got this kind of woman over here. And it's like, what the hell is with these people all over the place just doing this weird evil shit? And
yeah. Cool. Well, everybody has that impulse. I mean, inside of us, we all have that impulse to exploit other people or to just be evil. And it's like, you can understand it. And it's one of those things where, you have to kind of distill it down to an essential component that makes sense and then discuss that. And that's just more interesting, I think.
True. I can deal with that. So, very important question here.
Okay.
Cookies?
Yes.
What kind? Definitely.
What kind?
Yep.
Whatever's closest. That's my answer. I'm a chocolate chip cookie guy.
Okay, so you're a chocolate chip. You're a traditionalist.
Yeah, I'd probably go with chocolate chip. Peanut butter, I'll go for.
Okay, so you're close to the Canadian border, so you will have heard of maybe Fudgios.
Ooh, no, don't know Fudgios.
Do you like fudge?
Yeah.
Okay, so think of Oreos, but done with a fudge base as opposed to a chocolate or white cream.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
They are fantastic.
I like the ones that are 2 chocolate chip cookies with ice cream in the middle, too. That's a good one. That's a thing they had in Peru.
Okay.
Morochas, they were called. Morochas.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, they were good.
So you'd like to travel then, eh?
Yeah. Well, it's just one of those things where, in my presentation, I was talking about, it's like one of the things about when you aspire to be a writer, everybody always says have something to fall back on, which is sort of like a way of saying don't do it.
It's another way of saying don't quit your day job.
Yeah, but what they should say, though, is everybody who's a writer has to finance their writing. You know, you have to have, because writing is just, even if you're a very successful writer, you're not getting paid every Friday or every other Friday. So it's one of those things where it's like the truth is hidden in something that sounds kind of snarky, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to learn how to finance yourself. So my solution was to move to Lima, Peru, where I could live for almost nothing. And then you have all kinds of time. I wrote for the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. I wrote this article called An Ocean of Time, where it's just, I got down there and it's like, well, first of all, none of the people that were sending me bills knew where I was anymore. So I didn't have to pay them. But it's, you get so brainwashed. I mean, even your cell phone. I mean, what people spend on their cell phones is ridiculous.
And it's even worse when you're outside of the United States, where a lot of the cost is subsidized.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just don't even. I mean, you're spending $1,000 for your cell phone plus your $200 a month or whatever people spend.
Well, and if you're spend $200 a month on their cell phone.
Oh well, that's kind of a family. I don't know.
That's crazy.
Family plan. People get stuck. But I mean, it's like, I remember when I left and I didn't have to buy. I mean, I gave up my car, you know, so no car insurance and no gas, and I gave up my house and I gave up cable and all that. So I had no bills whatsoever, you know. And you just get in the habit of paying all these things like it's a part of life that you can't avoid. When you pack everything down to a backpack and leave the country, it's like, geez. In Peru, I was living in an apartment for $100 a month, you know, and
nice,
and that was pretty much it. And you know, I was going out to eat, but in a restaurant in Peru was like $5 at the time. It's more expensive now, but back then, you know, I used to go out pretty much every day and still not spend hardly anything. So it's just one of those eye openers where it's like, well, if I don't have to spend any money, you know, then I don't have to, you know, I just have more time. And what the critical thing of being a writer is, you need the time to just sit and reflect and work out the things that are bothering you. I mean, the inherent part of society is just to keep people busy so they don't realize all the different ways they're getting screwed over, essentially. So if you just take the time and just stop doing that, think things out, you might be able to come up with some conclusions that'll be of use to people.
What, you mean like stop and smell the roses?
Yeah.
or like turn the page and actually enjoy the flavor of the word?
Well, I mean, sort through the things that are in your head that are dictating your actions that were put there from people that aren't really necessarily acting in your best interest.
Whatever you do, do not say, just have the things that spark joy. Because I really don't like that one.
Well, okay, put it this way. When you go into a bank and ask for a loan, they evaluate how much you're making, and they tell you an amount of money that they can give you.
Yep.
That might be more than you need,
yep.
And that's to the interest of the bank and not to your interest.
Correct. Because
they want you in debt.
Because yes.
If you're paying interest, no matter how little it is, you're not earning interest, which would give you financial freedom.
Same as the credit card companies.
Yeah, but people think that they go in and like, oh, that banker was really nice to me. He told me I can have this much money. And then in their heads, they're thinking this person's an ally when it's an enemy.
Yeah. Well, anybody trying to get any kind of debt load like that should be thinking, how much can I afford?
Yeah.
Forget what other people think that you can afford. That's one side. If you can't afford it, you shouldn't be doing it.
But you look at things and like the whole structure of our society, well, American society, is to get you into debt. And, you know, it's like you can go get a college degree in Peru for pennies on the dollar compared to the United States once you've learned Spanish. But the United States doesn't teach foreign language, so you can't do that. So you start seeing, and it's not necessarily, I don't know, I guess it's like Plato's Republic. The government has to sit there and figure out a way to keep its people from, you know, being semi-productive and not degenerating into total chaos. But a lot of that is, and I mean, it is control. I mean, this isn't tinfoil hat territory. You do have to do it to have a functional civilization. But it is control.
Well, I would disagree on the functional civilization side of things.
Okay, keep it going.
I like anarchy, but that's not where I was going. Have you seen the movie WALL-E?
Yep.
So that's an entire society devoted on doing nothing.
Yeah. Well, I personally like anarchy myself, but that's not the purpose of a government, really, would you
no.
say?
No. Yeah. And I'm a small government person.
Yeah.
I don't want government in my life. I want government to make sure that when I'm trying to do something with somebody else over there, that those things in between, those are taken care of. Other than that, I don't want government anywhere near me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I want them to pave the roads. I want them to build the buildings. I want them to do the stuff that's all that. I'm willing to put my taxes into that because like, I work hard for my stuff. I want to make sure it's working good all everywhere.
Yeah.
But I don't want the government to say it's right or wrong to talk about this or not talk about that. It's like, that's got none of your business to do anything.
One of the things I think about is funny about that, because I agree, of course, but I always find that a lot of people that say, in the United States anyway, that they say they're proponents of small government, but then they endorse all these actions that the government does that aren't their business, which I don't know. Stuff like that. The two political parties, they do such a good job of making you get into a fight with a guy living right next door to you so that both the political parties can get paid massive amounts of your money.
You'd love up here in Canada. We have like up to 30 different political parties. Only 5 of them are on the main stage. But the other ones are still there. I mean, all of a sudden, everybody could decide to vote that party over there. It's like nobody's ever heard of them before. It's like, well, wait, they're in the government?
Yeah, that sounds pretty civilized. I think that's representative of a country that actually still listens to its voting public and doesn't control everything.
You could make arguments both ways on that as well. Like, our government is still kind of, really? What, were you listening to American radio when you said that? It's a game. Politics is all a game, but that's all I got to say. So, we're getting actually pretty darn close to done, because actually we are kind of like almost done, but...
Alrighty.
How can people find you?
I guess the easiest way, go to Streets of Lima. It's all no spaces, streetsoflima.com.
Oh, I was going to say, you're actually talking about telling people to go to Peru?
Yep, nope, it's my webpage, streetsoflima.com. I write mostly on there. At Streets of... That's at STS of Lima is my Twitter. Or find me on Facebook. I think I'll turn up. And because I use my same profile picture everywhere, they should know it's me. So.
Yes, it's pretty. Hey, look at me. I have an orange background.
Yeah. Can find me on, all my books are on Amazon, so that's fantastic. And I'm always happy to answer questions from people, so just send them over.
Excellent.
AlterRyan@gmail is how they can send me an email if they want to do that way.
Wonderful. And did you say you had a Twitter?
Yep, that's at STSOFLIMA.
I was going to say that sounds like something else, but I'm not going to say that.
All right.
Cool. Walter, great. Again, having you on the show. I appreciate it tremendously.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. I'd be happy to come back again anytime.
Great. I like having people come back on, because then we can continue the conversations, because this was... I didn't even touch half of the things I have here on my list of things to talk about.
Yeah, went fast. It was good.
Say hi to everybody in the Afterout Land.
Alrighty.
And everybody else in the Afterout Land, have yourselves an amazing Afterout and good time. Be happy, be well. Come back again every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Listen to me to ramble, or maybe next time I'll just bang a hammer every 5 minutes or something crazy, stupid, weird like that, because that's kind of sometimes how the zombie thinks. Have fun, enjoy, be well, and EW, I'm sure, is probably listening in the corner, is going to hit that little button that says, bing.
Have a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.